You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
But to begin with, a little bit about the motivation for the book. And really what it started with, to my mind, was a sense that something had happened in Canadian politics and in Canadian public life that was represented a fundamental line being crossed. And the way I think about this, actually, is to go back to where I learned how politics worked and debate, which was actually mainly in this house. This is my grandparents' house in Antigonish, Nova Scotia. Had a huge kitchen. My mother had 9 brothers and sisters, big Scottish Catholic family. The way you participated in a debate was to yell over everyone else until you had the conch, so to speak. And then you could talk until you made no sense. And then someone else would overrule you. But the thing about it, and in particular, living in the house now, my grandparents have passed away, but living in the house now is my Uncle Ron. And my Uncle Ron is a fantastic amateur historian, loves to talk politics. I debate with him often. We don't agree on a lot. But we both kind of came from the same political culture, so to speak. And so when we are having these discussions, and he's, was a career army officer, very, very much, sort of a, what I think of as a classic kind of Canadian conservative in the almost 19th century mold. And so we will have huge debates and great disagreements about all manner of things. But when I'm talking to my Uncle Ron about politics or about public life or about the direction of the country, whatever we're talking about, we ultimately come back to the same basic understanding of how the world works and what is true about what is happening in the world. If I say to him, well, actually there was a study and it said this, and that sort of negates your entire point, he'll concede it. The sort of shorthand for this is as a U.S. Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan once put it, you're entitled to your own opinions in a debate, but you're not entitled to your own facts. And I think where the line was crossed for me is we're moving into this sort of post-reality era in Canadian politics where apparently we're now also entitled to our own facts. And that was, for me, the initial motivation was that we had moved not just into strong disagreement about the direction of environmental policy, climate policy, energy policy, but into a realm where you could no longer expect that the government would have recourse to the same set of facts you were working under. And so that was sort of the beginning of my examination of the war on science. And as I examined it, I noticed that there were sort of 3 fronts in this war, if you will. And so I'll go through the 3 fronts and sort of briefly, and then we'll look at some of the particular points in a bit more detail. So the first of the 3 fronts is the sort of most basic piece of it. Less research, less data, less evidence. Actually reducing the government's own capacity to gather information. And this is something that we've been doing, as a country, as most democratic countries have, for, as long as we've been a country. I mean, the sort of simple shorthand for this is that, obviously, our weather reports begin at Environment Canada because Environment Canada has the capacity to monitor the weather across the nation. And no other public body or private body does. And what this government has actually done is begun to directly reduce the amount of fact it gathers. And this has been going on since 2006, when Stephen Harper was first became prime minister. It's grown much more severe in the majority year since 2011. But we've seen over the years, basically one after the other after the other, a series of basic data gathering capacities reduced. Everything from the long form census to the Experimental Lakes area in Northern Ontario, institutions closer to home here in Vancouver, like the Banfield Marine Sciences Center, which still gathers data but no longer shares it internationally in the time-honored scientific tradition because it no longer has the budget to do so. These are just 3 sort of prominent examples. The list goes on, and we'll come back to it, where that basic government capacity to get information, that idea that you can check with the government, with Statistics Canada, with Environment Canada, with Natural Resources Canada for the basic facts, that is being actively eroded. So that's the first front. In the long term, I think the most damaging, although it doesn't get as much attention maybe as some of the others. So the second front in this war on science is what we do with that. There is less analysis. There are fewer experts called upon, and they're very rarely listened to, and the result is increasingly bad policy from an evidence-based point of view. And this is another one where, you know, the examples are extraordinary. You know, that basically the shrinking and eliminating of offices, particularly in the environmental and natural sciences, but really across the board, that might demonstrate that the government's policy direction is at odds with the facts of the case. Not only that, but the ability to monitor the health of the nation generally, to respond to emergencies, to respond to crisis, all of that has been sort of actively reduced. Again, you know, you could show any number of examples, but these are some of the most prominent ones. The National Roundtable on the Environment and the Economy, which was, you know, a multi-stakeholder body for 25 years advising the government on how to think through climate and energy and economic policy, gone. You know, when it comes to refugee health care, we've seen under this government that basically the only way doctors get listened to in that debate is to protest in the street in their lab coats, or to, you know, just appear in front of government officials. Again, closer to home, the Joint Review Panel on the Northern Gateway Pipeline, where this sort of attack on science has moved outside the realm of government itself to NGOs, other third-party organizations that might use government data to advocate for particular kinds of policy. We've seen this direct attack on organizations such as Tides Canada, such as the Dogwood Institute, that have the temerity to tell Canadian citizens, here's what's happening in your world, and here's a way to get involved in it by appearing in front of the Joint Review Panel. This was declared, you know, basically a kind of foreign radical opposition to Canadian national interests. Not only that, but actually in the omnibus budget bill, which I'll be coming to, there was $8 million specifically set aside so that Revenue Canada could perform audits on organizations like those in order to reduce their ability to spend their resources on the important thing, which is telling Canadians what's happening in their world and what we should be doing about it. So that's the second front. And then the third is the one I think people find the most egregious and has gotten, you know, a lot of the most attention, which is the actual silencing of scientists. And I think the reason that that is, even though it's not maybe as widespread, why it's gotten the attention it has, is because it goes so deeply against not just Canadian tradition, but a global tradition of science in the public interest. That, you know, essential to the scientific method is that scientists are able to communicate freely about their work with other scientists, with the media and the public more recently. And this is a whole host of things, everything from, you know, strict message discipline to increasing centralization of message control to, in some prominent cases, the actual muzzling of scientists directly. Again, the list is too long and too numerous to mention. But I mean, just by way of recent local example, Christy Miller at University of British Columbia was not permitted to speak to the media about a major study that she completed on the salmon fishery. Had prepared a press release, was getting international attention for this study, and was told, you will not speak to the media under any circumstances. That's kind of the most egregious example. One of the most mundane and ridiculous was a story some of you may have seen in the Ottawa Citizen, where a reporter at the Ottawa Citizen wanted to, was writing a story basically about a new study about snowfall. Joint study between the National Research Council and NASA in the U.S., no more Canadian subject, surely, than snowfall. And so, you know, called NASA, spoke to a NASA scientist, got a quote, was ready to run the story, said, oh, well, I'll put in a request to the National Research Council so that I can speak to someone there and get the Canadian angle on it, and never heard back, you know, for hours and hours, then heard back, there will be no interview, we will get you some information, and then eventually heard back, actually, far too late, here is this bland policy brief. And the reporter in this case, the Ottawa Citizen reporter, actually put in a Freedom of Information request and kind of gave us this rare glimpse into the machine as it now churns. And it was, you know, 8 pages of documents, of these emails pinging back and forth between communications professionals and people in the National Research Council. And what it revealed was not some insidious attempt to keep people from talking about snowfall, but more a government that was just so terrified at the sort of, you know, everyday level of saying anything that might be deemed controversial or out of step with policy, out of step with government message discipline, that they would rather say nothing at all. I mean, just really absurdity more than anything. And in fact, there was a study recently by the Professional Institute of the Public Service of Canada, which is the union representing thousands of government scientists, where they surveyed government scientists. 37% of them said, at some point in the last 5 years, they've been blocked from speaking with the media or the public. Fully a quarter of them, 25%, said that they had been asked to omit or alter information for what they called non-scientific reasons. So, you know, in fact, shaping data or omitting data when it doesn't fit terribly to get well with the direction of policy. And that's really the fundamental shift here is, and I'll be coming back to this, is that we had established and more or less adhered to the idea that whoever the government of the day is, there is the civil service that is, you know, expert in its field, professional, nonpartisan, assembles data, acquires evidence, interprets it as best they can, and informs the government, this is what this means for your policy. And then policy ideally would be shaped based on what the data was saying. And now we've inverted that, where we have a policy, and then we look for only the data that encourages that, only the messages and only the information that encourage it. You put it all together, these three different fronts in the war on science, and you know, you do get sort of a take on the classic three ignorant monkeys. In the case of the Harper agenda, as I call it in the book, I would rephrase it. It's do no science, hear no science, speak no science, at least if it goes in any way against what has already been predetermined as the policy of the day. I'll get into the specifics of this and how it came to pass, but just as I, you know, sort of off the top, so we're clear at how extraordinary this shift has been, this is a absolutely partial list of where the losses have been in Canada's war on science, the casualties, if you will. The long-form census, the mandatory long-form census, of course, is gone. We now have a national household survey that costs more to administer and provides data that is being widely declared more or less useless in terms of its reliability. We've backed out of the Kyoto Accord and have no intention of entering any other international climate agreement. We decided not to adhere to the United Nations Vienna Declaration on HIV and AIDS, which was calling for evidence-based drug policy. One of the few of our traditional allies to do that. We're the only country in the United Nations no longer party to the Convention on to combat desertification. So basically, wherever, you know, extreme climate change is causing desertification, we are no longer part of that conversation. The Office of the National Science Advisor is gone. The funding for the Canadian Foundation for Climate and Atmospheric Science is gone. National Roundtable on the Environment and Economy, which I already mentioned. The Fisheries Act has been rewritten. The Navigable Waters Protection Act has been rewritten. The Department of Fisheries Habitat Management Program has been severely cut. 7 of 11 of the Department of Fisheries libraries have been closed forever. The National Aboriginal Health Organization and Canadian Women's Health Network both defunded. Parks Canada now closing some of its facilities in winter for lack of funding. And the National Research Council overhauled to serve as a concierge to industry. So that's a partial list of what has changed, most of it since the majority government came to power under Stephen Harper in 2011, although some of that stuff you could see coming prior to that. And so then the question becomes why? And there has been a lot of talk about what the motivation of this government might be for its war on science and a number of its other sort of more radical policy shifts. And rather than go through those, I think, you know, really you don't have to wonder at it. And one of the things that I found in writing this book, this sort of mystery, what is their agenda other than to get reelected and to consolidate power? It's actually very clear if you put the pieces together. The clearest articulation of it was Bill C-38, the omnibus budget bill in the spring of 2012, which was an incredibly radical document. No one had ever rewritten a Fisheries Act in a budget bill or the Navigable Waters Protection Act. In all, something like 70 separate pieces of legislation were altered, eliminated, or rewritten in a budget bill. That was the omnibus budget bill. It was an extraordinary document, probably, to my mind, the most reckless piece of legislation any Canadian government has passed in my lifetime. And when the government was talking about it, if you were listening carefully, they were very, very clear about what their intention was. Not here in Canada. It's funny about this government. They speak much more clearly once they're outside the country. Stephen Harper actually answers more questions when he's out of the country from reporters as well. But they were actually very clear about what the intent was. If you look at the Washington Post, June of 2012, just as this legislation was being passed, Washington Post ran a story, spoke to Christopher Plunkett, who was the Canadian government spokesman in Washington, and he laid it out as clearly as anyone has. The idea is simple and straightforward: to make Canada the most attractive country in the world for research investment and development. That is the number one item, other than consolidating and retaining power, on this government's agenda. It was the full intent of the war on science to facilitate this process. Bill C-38 was certainly aimed at it. Oh, and by the way, Christopher Plunkett did go on to say, and enhance our world-class protection of the environment today for future generations of Canadians. Because if you are in the midst of dismantling a time-honored Canadian tradition, you have to at least pay lip service to thinking it was worthwhile. Part of the sort of brazen approach to dismantling this sort of scientific tradition, environmental protection and stewardship tradition, that they constantly pay lip service to it as they're doing. In fact, as we speak, I think it was just yesterday that the environment minister, Leona Aglukkaq, was in Warsaw for the COP19 climate talks and stated baldly, you know, that Canada intends to take a leadership role in combating climate change. And what they mean by that is they intend to say that they are taking a leadership role, which is the sum total, as far as I can tell, of what a leadership role is to state that you're taking one. In any case, absolutely clear about what they were intending to do, which is, you know, open for business. We are, you know, hewers of water and drawers of water and hewers of wood. We do that well. Let's do more of it. Let's do as much of it as we possibly can. Make the economy, you know, hum along to the lucrative flow of revenues from resource extraction, and as much as possible, ignore the second part of that sentence regarding, or not even ignore, but actually undo the second part of that sentence. And this is actually a pretty fundamental breach. It's not just a difference in policy. Coming back to these arguments with my Uncle Ron, where this has gone off the rails, sort of outside the boundaries, to my mind, is just how fully it has broken with a tradition as old as the country itself of science in the public interest, of environmental stewardship. And so let me take you through that history a little bit. This was actually the part, when I was putting the book together, that I found the most fascinating to go back and look at how it is that Canadian government got into the science business in the first place. How did we start employing scientists, founding institutions, all of that? And you can't point to any one thing, but probably the real kind of foundational moment for Canadian science was a huge wave of Scottish immigration that started in the 1820s. And this was news to me. If you go back to the 19th century, Scottish universities were actually the leading Commonwealth universities, leading universities in the empire, in a number of the natural sciences. The sort of grand old English institutions, Oxford and Cambridge, much more focused on sort of classical scholarship. University of Edinburgh, University of Glasgow, these were the leading science institutions of their time. And a whole bunch of these immigrants came to Canada, including, as I've shown here, Sir Stanford Fleming, who was one of the co-founders of the Royal Canadian Institute. That's the original institute building in Toronto. At the right there. Sanford Fleming, among other things, the very first presentation of the idea of standard time was under the auspices of the Royal Canadian Institute. He was not alone. Scots came to Canada and founded the Geological Survey of Canada and a number of other institutions. Canada's Royal Society was also founded during the same time. This was the dawn of the first meteorological and marine observation stations in Canada all through the sort of second half of the 19th century. And so that's really the foundation of this tradition, was that it was a new country and there was lots to discover. The Geological Survey is a great example of that, where the obvious sort of overarching intent was to find resources worth exploiting. But along the way, Canada became the sort of treasure trove of new scientific knowledge as the digging occurred. Paleontology is the most obvious example, where, you know, the rich finds, including the Badlands of Alberta, one of the richest dinosaur bone finds on the planet, uncovered as we were hunting for resources, and along the way became, you know, an important landscape for science as well as resource extraction. That said, Canada, as a colony and as a young nation, still very much focused on resource extraction, making money off of the things that can be pulled out of the ground and cut down and drawn out of the water and the rest of it. Where the government really changed and shifted to a much more sort of deliberate focus on the sciences was under what many consider maybe our most boring prime minister, Sir Robert Borden. Sir Robert Borden, when he was first named the head of the Conservative Party in the 1890s, didn't want the job, didn't think he was up to the job, described it himself as an absurdity for the party and madness for me. Borden was not considered a natural leader, was not considered a dynamic speaker or anything like that. When he finally retired, actually, one of the journalists of the day said that, you know, when someone finally writes his political biography, it'll be a book that will bore the people to death. That said, Borden, for all his dullness, was a deeply committed social reformer and government reformer, very much in the what would eventually become the progressive conservative tradition in Canada. To that point, the civil service in Canada was rife with cronyism and corruption and patronage. It was, you know, the government of the day appointed their friends to run all of the major civil service agencies. It was under Borden first during World War II, and then with the Civil Service Act in 1918, that the idea of these arm's-length institutions, things like the Central Experimental Farm, which you can see there, the National Research Council, which was founded during World War I to provide key research and technology development for the war effort, these institutions were founded under Robert Borden and then placed in this tradition where they've more or less remained until the arrival of our 22nd prime minister, which is more or less arm's length, very much based on merit, on expertise, get the best people, put the best minds to it, find the best data, the best evidence, use that to inform government. There's always been a to and fro about how much of that evidence we want to pay attention to and the rest of it. But until this government, there had never been so thorough an attack on the basic foundations, the basic idea that pure science, certain kinds of basic data and research are definitely the federal government's purview. There's lots of stuff from the weather on down that only the government has the capacity to do, and that this is vital to the national interest. Incidentally, there emerged out of this, going all the way back to the Geological Survey, a homegrown expertise in the natural sciences. Makes sense for a huge country with extraordinary natural resources that we would be very good at the natural sciences. And that led to, by roughly the 1960s, 1970s, a pretty extraordinary flowering of government science, sort of a golden age of government science beginning in the 1960s, where particularly in certain of the natural sciences, aquatic science, atmospheric science, these sorts of things, more so than the universities, it was government institutions that led. And this actually ushered in, I think, what many Canadians still think of as their true tradition in environmental stewardship and in the natural sciences, which, you know, going into the 1970s and 1980s, was a Canada that constantly took a lead role in matters of global import on environment and on climate. Among other things, of course, the Montreal Protocol, which was the first international action on the depletion of the ozone layer, named for the country where it was signed, the country that was one of the lead actors in getting it through and did most of the some of the most important research to get it to develop the science of ozone depletion, which of course was Canada. Similarly, Canadian science, Canadian government research in the public interest led to our understanding of the processes by which sulfur dioxide emissions were causing acid rain, leading to the acid rain treaty signed between Brian Mulroney and George H.W. Bush in the late 1980s. This was really kind of the full flowering of that Borden tradition of science in the public interest, where we were not just sort of taking care of our own little nest and finding out where the best resources lay. We were breaking through leading conversations, even in the climate sphere. It's amazing when you go back, particularly given what has happened to the conversation about climate change at the federal level in this country. We were absolutely at the forefront, our government, our federal government, under a conservative, a progressive conservative, Brian Mulroney, we were at the absolute forefront of that first wave of conversation about climate change. And in the process of writing the book, I spoke to a great climate scientist by the name of John Stone, who worked for many years in the climate modeling group at Environment Canada. And he talked about, you know, so 1988, one of the first major international meetings on climate change among scientists. One of the scientists actually called it Woodstock for climatologists. Happened 1988 in Toronto, hosted by the federal government with a keynote speech by Brian Mulroney. We were way out in front of this conversation. We were having a much more grown-up, mature, thoughtful conversation about it in 1988 than we are today, for the most part. But anyway, John Stone, when I was talking to him, talked about 1990, which was the next big round of international climate talks, leading eventually to the Rio Summit and Kyoto Protocols and the rest of it. And he described what it was like to be in Geneva at a climate talk as a government scientist in 1990. Here's the quote. He said, "It was mixed and it was very open. I remember sitting around this big table at our embassy where the meeting was held, and these members of parliament from all the different parties quite openly discussing Canadian positions and things like this." And this is one of the huge differences, a very rapid shift from previous governments to the current one. The idea that no matter how much, you know, how rancorous the House of Commons grows, how viciously elections are contested, once you form a government, you serve in the public interest to take care of the country. You get the best people, even if they are from across the aisle, to advise you on policy and tell you what they think. You work together collaboratively on the important issues of the day. That was certainly the case under Brian Mulroney. among other things, not a lot of people know this. I didn't know it until fairly recently that Brian Mulroney's environment ministry was an extraordinarily progressive, forceful, dynamic environment ministry, maybe the best we've ever had. And I would credit at least some part of that to the fact that one of the senior policy advisors in the environment ministry at the time was a woman by the name of Elizabeth May, who has since, of course, gone on to lead the Green Party of Canada and worked, you know, happily in a, or more or less happily, in a conservative government, groundbreaking policy. Now, what was happening at the same time all this was happening, the late 80s, early 90s, was in some sense the kind of test run for the Harper Agenda's approach to science. And that test run, which should have taught us the other lesson, the opposite lesson, was the collapse of one of the most abundant fisheries in human history and the planet's history, the collapse of the Atlantic cod fishery on the east coast of Canada. You can see, I mean, in the pictures almost tell the story. The picture at top left there, that's a small Newfoundland boy standing with cod to give them scale, the size of cod they used to drag out of the water. When that fishery first got going, of course, the early reports, if you go back to the explorer days, talked about fish so abundant in the water that you could almost walk across it, and right up into modern times, you could almost see that. But what began to happen, and this is a story that's happening again and again as we talk about natural resources and the state of the climate, the rest of it, is starting in the post-war period, the scale of our ability to exploit these resources, there was just a absolutely exponential shift in that scale. To give numbers to it, in the 15 years from 1960 to 1975, as much cod was harvested from the Grand Banks as in the first 250 years of that fishery, from 1500 to 1750. So in the 15 years leading up to 1975, we did 250 years worth of pre-industrial scale fishing. And of course, what that meant was you had to start looking further and further afield for the scale of fishing that you were doing. In 1979, Canada extended its coastal jurisdiction from 3 miles to 200 for the purposes of cod fishing. And the other thing that happened in the late 1970s was that a whole host of organizations, including some of those old Robert Borden, arm's length kind of scientific research bodies, were consolidated in what eventually became known as the Department of Fisheries and Oceans. And the Department of Fisheries and Oceans was kind of a case study in what happens if you let politicians dictate the science. In particular, if you look at the 1991 quota set for the Canadian fishing fleet in for Atlantic cod, there was on the table from the scientists a conservation scenario which recommended 100,000 tons be caught that year during the fishing season. And this was, when it eventually came to the bureaucracy to be discussed, was presented against catches of 150,000 or 170,000 tons. And to this point, the DFO had been sort of habitually ignoring early warnings that the catches were declining. They were overestimating stocks, more or less by habit. And so they decided we don't need to worry about the conservation scenario, no matter what the scientists are telling us. Business as usual was 200,000 tons. So let's disregard those low estimates. We'll go with 190,000 tons. And so that was the 1991 quota. It is the last year Canada had an industrial cod fishery. It was the year of the collapse. The lesson of that should have been that politics and science need a certain amount of church and state sort of separation, that you do actually need scientists to be able to work in the scientific tradition and present you clearly with data and the implications of that data before you get down to policy. You might still decide to overfish, but at least be clear about what you're doing. It seems more or less like a lot of the senior bureaucracy didn't fully understand the implications of what they were doing in the cod fishery. Most people, I think, would probably come to the reasonable lesson that the cod fishery taught us that even a resource that was once called so abundant that unless nature reversed, we could not possibly fish all the cod in the North Atlantic. If we could exploit that to depletion and to collapse, we ought to be a lot more careful about the science around our resource extraction. The Harper Agenda turns that on its head and more or less says, well, if the data is telling us that we're going to get in trouble and shows what an error we've made, let's stop gathering data as much as possible. Let's just get rid of that pesky data wherever we possibly can, particularly as regards our current plans, policy-wise, for resource extraction. And so we'll look at a couple of key examples of what that Harper Agenda has meant on the ground for certain research bodies, some of them no longer part of the federal government. And I'll begin, actually, with what many consider to be one of the crown jewels of Canadian science, the Experimental Lakes area in Northern Ontario. For those of you not familiar with it, it's 58 lakes, actual lakes. It's not a lab. It's a giant sprawling piece of Northern Ontario. 58 lakes that were set aside in 1968 to do something that no the aquatic scientists had never been able to do before, which is experiment at a whole ecosystem level on the issues of the day. And this was not esoteric, sort of let's see what happens kind of stuff. It was very, very much directed at the biggest issues of the day. One of the first great experiments, this was predominantly under David Schindler, who's truly one of the giants of Canadian science in the 20th century, just retired from the University of Alberta. Schindler's, one of his first big experiments was responding to the fact that there'd been this huge eutrophication problem in the Great Lakes and other freshwater bodies across North America. Huge algae blooms, basically choking the life out of a lot of our freshwater. And although scientists had long suspected that it had something to do with industrial runoff, particularly phosphates, no one had been able to prove it. What Schindler was able to do, because of the unique nature of the Experimental Lakes area, was do an actual study. Cut a lake in half, inundate one half of it with phosphates, and the other leave in a more or less static state, and then see what happens over the course of a couple of years. And what happened, of course, is exactly what was happening on the ground and in the water across North America, these huge algae blooms. This led directly to restrictions on industrial phosphate use across North America and eventually around the world, and was the first of many of the huge breakthroughs that the ELA pioneered. One of the other ones, of course, was discovering the mechanism by which acid rain occurs, led directly to the acid rain treaty and the increasing reductions of sulfur dioxide and other acid rain-causing contaminants worldwide. So what the ELA was at its core, and remains, even though it is no longer part of this government, the federal government, in terms of financing, was an organization that essentially looked into the cost of resource extraction. That's not the only thing it did, but that's a huge amount, and large-scale industrial production. That was really their main focus and their claim to fame around the world. And it is a world-renowned, one-of-a-kind research institution. That cost a princely sum of $2 million a year to keep running for all of the world-class research it was doing. And if you think about what this government's aim is, its stated aim, to make Canada the most attractive country in the world for resource investment and development, it stands to reason in all of the budget cutting you're doing, in all the myriad ways you can reduce a government's budget, that you might target this little tiny research body that a lot of Canadians haven't heard of that happens to constantly find startling things about the cost of resource extraction and industrial development. You might decide, you know what, that's kind of a nuisance. We really would rather not directly fund that. We would rather not have to answer to our own bureaucracy as we expand our resource base. Another example of the kind of cuts that have gone on. This is Pearl, the Polar Environment Arctic Research Lab. This is the most northernmost research station in Canada, one of the most northerly in the world, one of the only ones. That operated and is beginning to maybe operate again year-round. So one of the only data-gathering centers that could tell us what atmospheric conditions, climate conditions, weather conditions look like in the long Arctic night, in those long months where the sun does not shine at all far north. And you would think, if a government has made a priority of Arctic sovereignty, a priority of making the Arctic more a part of Canada, whether that be from a resource base, a resource extraction point of view or not, that this, for $1.5 million a year, would be very high priority. It's your only piece of information in the high Arctic. It is the only thing that can tell you just how difficult it might be to do oil exploration and oil extraction, for example, in that region. So was it just random that Pearl, which happened to be funded by the Canadian Foundation for Climate and Atmospheric Science, got cut in the Bill C-38 cuts, or was there a reason why that, and that's open to, that's an open question with a hopefully obvious answer. Incidentally, Pearl was, after basically going dormant, having to shut down operations for the winter of 2012-2013, seemingly arbitrarily had its funding restored at the exact moment, literally the exact day, that the Prime Minister was in New York claiming that Canada had a world-class environmental stewardship regime and could be trusted with large-scale pipeline development and the rest of it. So Pearl is back up and running. No one knows for how long. One of the things, and I'll come back to this, that happens when you so arbitrarily defund incredibly important resource institutions is that the scientific community worldwide stops trusting you. There have already been scientists who've left Canada for other postings abroad because of the closure of some of these facilities and this general sense that this is a government not that interested in science. Even when that science is not directed, by the way, at obvious sort of sensitive targets in the climate and environmental sciences. One of the most interesting things I found in researching this book was what the Harper Agenda has meant for the National Research Council. And the National Research Council, you know, another one of the jewels of Canadian federal government science, has been doing all kinds of interesting research. A lot of it, by the way, contrary to popular belief, and certainly contrary to the belief of this government, not esoteric blue sky thinking, very much applied research focused. But basically the order came down that the National Research Council needed to become more business friendly, that these eggheads were not pointed at the right problems. In fact, a remarkable quote, in my sense, one of the most perfectly phrased voices of the attitude of this government towards science. Gary Goodyear, the former Minister of State for Science and Technology in March 2012, when he announced this restructuring of the National Research Council, said it will be hopefully a one-stop, 1-800, I have a solution for your business problem type of organization. I mean, I won't claim to have read exhaustively, but I think this is the most ignorant thing someone's ever said about the role of the National Research Council. It certainly greatly misrepresents what the National Research Council does. I'll give you a case study, mainly because it's a great example of the kind of stuff that, if you're a cabinet minister, for example, this is exactly the kind of case study you would use to demonstrate, look at the great things we're doing, creating new business and new industry and new economic opportunity through this thing that we fund. And that is the rise directly out of the National Research Council of Canada's 3D computer graphics industry. World-renowned computer graphics industry has won Oscars, has developed a lot of the technology that brings us 3D movies and all manner of other things. And if you go back to where that actually started in a digital music research lab at the National Research Council in the early 1970s. And a gentleman by the name of Bill Buxton, who was a motorcycle-riding hippie who liked music and was a student at the time at Queen's University and heard about this digital music lab that the NRC had and rode his motorbike up to Ottawa and started playing around. There was these very interesting input devices for the digital music machine. One of them is a thing we now know as a mouse. It was brand new at the time. And he really became more interested in the input mechanisms than the music they produced. And the more he got to playing with them, the more he started to realize that there were other things that could be done with them. And out of that arose a couple of companies, Alias Wavefront and Silicon Graphics, both of which became the sort of foundation over the course of about 15, 20 years of Canada's computer graphics industry. And no one thinking of themselves as running a 1-800, I have a solution for your business problem organization would have said, let's let this hippie play around with music tools in this lab, because eventually that will lead to 3D graphics. That's simply not how technology happens. It's not how innovation happens. And it was one of the more fascinating things. I had some people inside the National Research Council anonymously slipping me information. Just not that it was highly sensitive. It just gave you a sense of the culture of the place. It felt a lot like an organization that had been sort of picked up and shaken. And no one quite knew why. But, well, we got to change things. And so now it's business focused. And there's all this crazy jargon about how it is you put your research in alignment with business interests and 1-800 business problem solutions. And my main source, who was a fascinating interview, this is how he put it. This is his sense of the tone of this government. What I'm seeing is more like a small town hardware merchant, not willing to invest in anything if it's not going to pay off in the next 6 months. Cash on the barrel. Let's not worry about the big picture. What can we make money at right now? With very little in the way of understanding of how that happens at a technological innovation point of view. A weird sort of admiration and contempt. This is another thing that my NRC source talked about, where on the one hand, you eggheads are way off in your blue sky thinking. You got to be tethered back to some kind of business focused sort of thing. But at the same time, this total lack of understanding, the idea that if you were a scientist, you knew so much science that you could just be directed you know, at any given widget and know how it worked, even though your whole life you've been working in this particular very, very narrow bit of chemistry, say, well, no, now what we need is people to work on agricultural science, so we're just going to point resources at that. Surely you scientists can, you know, repurpose on the fly. So it's a very weird sort of thing. It's one of the things when we talk about the Harper Agenda, I don't think that there's necessarily any grand overarching ideological sort of thing going on. It really is that small town hardware merchant's point of view. Why are we wasting money on this? This just gets in the way of business. Let's stick to, you know, drawing the water, hewing the wood, worry about the problems if and when they come up, do as little as possible with the problems as they arise, and just, you know, make hay while the sun shines, so to speak. Of course, this has led to a pretty extraordinary backlash, not just in Canada, but around the world. One of the biggest impacts, I think, of this war on science is Canada's reputation internationally. Once at the absolute forefront, thought of one of the leading nations in science and environmental stewardship, now considered the worst of the laggards. And in fact, this is now, I mean, as the climate talks are going on right now in Warsaw, Canada scored worst in the industrial world, 58th out of 61 in a study of climate action. The only country, so worst in the industrial world and slightly better than countries like Saudi Arabia in terms of our climate policy. And of course, there's been, you know, everything from protests to Fossil of the Day awards to you know, censure in major scientific journals, attention from the press worldwide, basically in sort of shock. This is not the Canada we thought we knew. What could possibly be going on here? And it's, you know, a good point, because there's probably not a single issue I can think of anyway where we are as fully out of step with what we consider to be our traditional allies as our federal policy or lack thereof on climate change as the sort of signal event. I had a very interesting panel discussion on TVO while I was doing publicity for this book, and one of the other panelists I thought put it really well when he said, you know, this is like the lack of seriousness being paid to climate change is kind of like the original sin, and all of the other, if you look at all the other sort of strangeness that comes out of this government science policy, it emerges from that initial distrust of what we know about climate science, and it really most clearly illustrates how far out of step with the community we consider ourselves part of that we've become. So implicit in this, though, is a sort of wager. When we come back to the, you know, I talked about the message discipline and the central media control. And the wager is that you can continue to run a government, get reelected, if you do such a good job of messaging and essentially propaganda that no one notices what you buried in your budget bills or thinks of it as particularly important, at least. And that is the Harper Agenda's wager. They've staked good money on it. They've spent about $120 million so far embedding the phrase economic action plan in Canadian minds. Hockey Night in Canada ads, you know, the billboards all across the country. Basically this barrage of messaging, $120 million worth of it, to make Canadians feel on some sort of site, you know, deep, unconscious even level, that our economy is doing well. And so that anything that goes against that would be messing with a good thing. Another $30 million, I mean, I could point to lots of other strange spending, but $30 million was what it cost to commemorate the War of 1812. That was considered a high enough priority that it was worth spending $30 million on. And this is basically to hide the fact that what they're really putting forward is a comprehensive vision for the country diametrically opposed to its long tradition as a scientific leader and an environmental steward. And the bet is that you won't notice. And in fact, just, I keep meaning to do a full kind of number crunch on this, but to give $150 million in federal spending, just, you know, kind of a contrary or counterweight, you could fund the ELA, PEARL, the Arctic Research Station, and the National Roundtable on Environment and Economy for 15 years for $150 million. Sorry. So we threw away 15 years of three vital research bodies in order to talk about our economic action plan and the War of 1812. And that, I think, is important to remember when as is this government's tendency, we talk about the importance of the economy and jobs and the economy and jobs and the economy and jobs, and the idea that you know, we had to cut certain kinds of wasteful spending in order to keep moving forward on the economy and jobs. They spend more money talking about economy and jobs than actually employing scientists in jobs that are useful to the economy. In any case, so what do we do about this if it is something of concern? I assume if you're here that it is. The good thing is the response, the counterattack, so to speak, has already begun. It began, you could trace it further back, but more or less the day the ELA was defunded. This is Diane Orehel, researcher at the Experimental Lakes area, one of the few researchers at the Experimental Lakes area who was not a federal government employee. More or less within a week of the defunding of the ELA, she had become the founder of the Save the ELA organization. Like a lot of the people involved in this response, thought of herself as a scientist, as a lab rat, as someone who walks around in hip waders in lakes in Northern Ontario, not as someone who lobbies government officials and organizes protests, but felt that deeply compelled by what was happening to get involved. Wound up, you know, taking petitions to Ottawa, that sort of thing, met some other like-minded activists, and in the summer of 2012 staged one of the most extraordinary protests in the history of Canadian politics, the Death of Evidence March on Parliament Hill. If you didn't catch it when it was happening, it was, you know, in mid-July. Basically, it was 2,000 people at least, a great many of them scientists in lab coats. Some very, very clever signs. I like the citation needed sign. That's my favorite. Basically marching on Parliament, not to say, you know, we advocate for this particular policy position or this government or this party over the other, but to say whatever the government of the day is doing, the science is sacrosanct. You are not allowed to simply dismiss evidence out of hand. And this goes against, so goes against our sense of what science is, that we are willing, reluctantly most of them, to put on our lab coats and march in the streets of Ottawa. And since that first march, the momentum coming out of that has led to the founding of several fantastic organizations, one of whom is here with us tonight, Evidence for Democracy, founded by Katie Gibbs, who was one of the founders of this march as well. I know that at the University of Toronto, there's an organization called Scientists for the Right to Know doing similar advocacy work. I'm sure there are organizations here in the Lower Mainland doing stuff that I haven't even heard about yet, but definitely there is a response happening.